Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm going to talk a little bit about the danger of changing. And I'm going to play an interview with playwright Jack Gilhooly. And in Jack's story, you will hear not an uncommon story. One of a man who quite young found his passion, plays, but had to wade through the things that were expected of him, the things he thought he had to be, what everybody else was doing, what he thought was right or correct, so that he could find his way back to his essential self, his love of reading, writing, producing, being part of plays. It's an interesting story. So hang on. Here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down you dive, where the child's gone to survive. Finding wisdom's other words. Oh, you really can. And it's always there, like a silent hug from no.
Hello, and welcome to The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is all about figuring out and then finding a way to become who you really are. If you've been listening, you know that I believe that all of us are pretending to some extent to be something we're not. Well, that's not exactly right. All the things that we are saying we are, acting as we are, we actually are those things. But then we're so much more that we had to pretend we weren't. And we got so good at pretending that we weren't those things that we not only convinced everyone else, we convinced ourselves. And so it is the challenge of us all, I believe, and the thrust of this show, to point out that we are all so much more. And that we may need that more to do whatever we need to do in our life. So in the last, well, I don't know how many shows, I've been talking about my concepts of cover story, that is what you present that is really true of you, but that's not the whole truth, and then your undercover, which is contains all those things that you decided wouldn't work. get you in trouble. They would embarrass you. They would shame you. They would get you hurt, even neglected. Whatever it was that made you deny parts of yourself. So today I'm just going to talk a little bit about something I believe, which a lot of people don't talk about. A lot of us want to change. We want to do things that we have not been able to do, or stop doing things that we have been doing. And we don't really understand why we're having so much trouble with it. Because if we want to make some change, it's because we think our life will be enhanced by that. But I want to just give you a kind of heads up that when you haven't been doing something that you want to do, or you want to start doing something you haven't been doing, did I say that the same way twice? There's a danger attached, which you may not be consciously aware of. So please, just take a minute to consider the idea that there's a danger attached to whatever it is you want to do differently. And you can do this simply by thinking about the change you want to make, what it is you want to do, and noticing whether you feel even slightly anxious. Is there a queasiness in the pit of your stomach or a tiny tension in your jaw or your shoulder muscles? It isn't necessary to name the danger to recognize that it exists. Even if you can't identify a specific danger or isolate the source of your anxiety, even if you think it's silly to suspect an unrecognized danger, please consider the possibility that making the change that you want to make, doing whatever it is that you want to do but can't do, scares you. I will be talking in the next few weeks about the kinds of dangers that stop us from doing what we want to do, changing in the ways we want to change, and of course specifically surfacing those undercover qualities which we decided so very long ago we could not use. And remember, undercover qualities are not just things that when you think of them you think they're ugly, so I don't know. And then I'm fond of saying that all qualities can be seen as good and bad. So thrift, you know, the ability to save money, to be cautious about money, can also be penny pinching and hoarding and the inability to enjoy what you actually have, right? Shyness, the ability not always to be center stage, can be a good thing, because if you don't ever know how to listen to another, you miss a lot. On the other hand, if all you know how to do is listen and you never know how to present yourself, obviously, that quality can be either one. So whatever your undercover quality was, whatever those things you had to hide and are currently not only hiding from the world, but hiding from yourself, and you may need them now. You may need to know how to save. I mean, maybe in this absurd economy that we're in, before you could spend with impunity. But maybe now you need that quality and you don't know that you have it. You don't know how to find it inside yourself. Or maybe it was okay to hang back and not put yourself forward in any way previously. But now maybe you need that quality in order to keep your job or get your job. So that quality that you had hidden and which you didn't actually need until recently, you may need. But it may be dangerous to surface that quality. And so in the next few weeks, I'm going to be talking more and more about what are the dangers of surfacing an undercover quality and what you can do about that. But now I'm going to play an interview I did with Jack Gilhooly, playwright, first, foremost, and ever a playwright. If you were listening to my lead into the show, you know that some of this interview is going to be about the way Jack waded through the things he thought he had to be to get back to what he always knew he was, a playwright. to hear in his own words, Jack Gilhooly.
So I'm here with Jack Gilhooly and out on his lanai looking at this lovely view. I interview people who make their living or their life with their art. I always ask them the same question, and that is, how did your art capture you? How did it happen? How did it start? When did you know?
I didn't know what I was... I didn't know that I was involved as a kid, but I was always kind of the bizarre kid in my high school. I went to an all-male parochial high school in West Philadelphia, and I spent a lot of time at foreign films, for instance, and I read a lot of beat poetry and novels. I think On the Road came in when I was in high school. I was probably the only kid in the high school to read it. And I was always off. I used to go to the Jazz at the Philharmonic concerts, and there was nobody else in my high school who went, except for a couple of black kids who I'd see in the audience. But in those days, you didn't go with them. You just happened to run into them. So I was always kind of a little off. And then I went to University of Pennsylvania at the age of 17. I landed, much of my father's influence, in the Wharton School. And
isn't that business?
Yeah, that's business. But I didn't know it. You were 17, you obey your parents, or at least I did. I'm not like kids today who are much luckier because they disobey their parents. But I wound up at a Wharton School, and I spent most of my time reading plays. And I was a wonderful play reader, probably the best play reader in the entire Wharton School. But I wasn't a very good student. So they asked me to leave after three semesters, and I wound up at Syracuse Drama.
Wait. So I'm assuming that neither one of your parents is particularly interested in...
My mother was a pianist, but she was not as good as she thought she was, but that's probably where it comes from. She was a pianist. She majored in music in college. But she never pushed me. They never pushed me into... I mean, they really kind of pushed me into a middle-class, nice, stage, stable... My father was managed an insurance company, and I was all set to go in there, which is why I went off to Wharton School, but it just didn't appeal to me. And so I wound up much of my father's consternation at Syracuse Drama, and that's when I started really reading voraciously. But I didn't start writing plays until I probably hit 30. And I was teaching college in New Jersey and spending so much of my time with all my college friends who had gone on to New York and off-Broadway and off-Broadway and once in a while Broadway. And I spent so much time with them and saw so much theater, I finally said to myself, I better get moving here and make something of myself. And then I started writing plays. And I was very fortunate insofar as I had my first play produced off Broadway in 1973, and by 1975 it was being produced by Joseph Papp. So that was moving a little too fast, I think. In retrospect, it was not a happy situation. It was not a happy situation at all. I know there's a new book out on Papp that Papp tried to suppress when the book was in progress many, many years ago. As a matter of fact, he did forbid it from being published. And now he's been dead for, I don't know, 16 years or so. I think he died in 92. And finally, the widow Papp, Gail Merrifield, has given permission for the book to be published. And I can't wait to see it. He was a rather cantankerous guy and kind of tough to get along with and very day-to-day. One day, you're his newfound young playwright friend, and the next day, you're on the outs, but you never know why. I suppose it had to do with his own root feelings and the side of the bed he got up on. Anyway, I was with him for a while, and one of the things I remember best I remember a lot of things about the Papp, couple of years, but one of the things was he used to, when I was having a play called The Time Trial in rehearsal in 1975 with a wonderful cast including Tommy Lee Jones, and in the middle of rehearsals, halfway through the rehearsal period, you know, the playwright gets pretty bored because the actors are neither here nor there, they don't know their lines, and they do know their lines, and anyway, there's nothing you can do, you can't really rewrite the play if they don't know their lines, and so he realized I was kind of getting antsy and bored and wasting time. So he'd send me next door to a project that, a musical project that was going on next door, and I'd sit in the back of the house. I was the only one there during the rehearsals, and I immediately determined that this thing is not going to work at all. The lead actress, dancer, actress, was screaming at the director in the audience, having something to do with the fact that they had been lovers in the past.
This is chorus line, isn't
work.
It?
Yeah. You saw that coming, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
And I'd sit there for about three rehearsals, and finally Pap said to me, "What do you think of this play?" I said, "You better close it down. This thing isn't going to work." And then I finally caught on, and then I realized it was going to be a masterpiece. So anyway, ever since then I've been writing plays, and I came down here because for various reasons, primarily because I married, and my wife lives here and is kind of attached here and has a business here, and I had gotten fed up with the New York theater scene. I was just coming off a really bad hit in off-Broadway, which really irritated me because a friend of mine produced it, and I put all my faith in her, and there were a lot of violations there. And
you said a bad hit.
Yeah.
Now, does that mean that the play was a hit, but the experience was bad?
No, I took the hit.
Oh, you took the hit.
The play was good.
Mm-hmm.
All my plays were
what
good.
What happened?
Well, for one thing, I knew that the company she assembled was not very good. And because of my friendship with her late husband, I allowed her to produce this play and to star in the play, the problem right there, of course, to produce this play and star in the play with this understanding that there'd be no press. I didn't want any press. I didn't want the New York Times coming. And at that point, I could command the New York Times. I mean, my name would draw a New York Times critic. And the actors understood it, so it was really kind of a extended workshop. Mm-hmm. And as it turned out, there were problems with it. Maybe some of them were mine, but she turned around and invited the New York Times. And they came, and they rather liked the play, but they disliked the production. So that doesn't do you any good. Nobody's going to show up if they like the play but not the production. So I got very fed up, and at the same time, I was in line for a position at Arizona State University. And I flew out there, and there were 126 candidates, and I finished second.
Wow.
And I lost out to a friend, so that made me feel even more depressed. And I came down here courtesy of FST, I'm using that word courtesy rather loosely, and happened to stay.
Do you mean that they said maybe we'll do a play, or...
Well, I was the first. Everybody thinks that the first artist colony down here is the Hermitage, but it wasn't the first. The first was the Florida Studio Theater Artist Colony, which was very short-lived for very specific reasons. It was not a good experience. Let me put it that way. And a couple of other people who came down as artists at their invitation turned around and went home immediately, I mean overnight. But we won't get into that any more than I have. And I realized that to move down here is pretty much to cut your New York ties, but I thought I was good enough that I could overcome that problem, but it ain't so.
No, you have to be up there.
You have to be up there, you have to be connected, especially as you get older. The people I knew up there 25 years ago are gone or dead or got some brains and went into another area. So it doesn't do me any good anymore to put a manuscript in the mail. In fact, I'll give you one. I have a play with my co-author, a co-author named Daniel Citram, who's a wonderful historian out of Mount Holyoke. A play about the Triangle Fire in New York City, the politics behind the Triangle Fire in New York City. And Danny called me a few months ago and he said, "You know, our time has come. 2011 is our time."
For this play.
Now, why is that?
Was it 1911,
right. It's the 100th anniversary of the Triangle Fire in New York City, which I assume most of your listeners know about. And they're going to be considered, they're going to be commemorative, commemorations. The city is financing some of these, and private funds are financing some of these. We are anticipating this, and I've started sending manuscripts out to various downtown theaters. I say downtown theaters because it was very much a downtown event.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to fly so much on Fifth Avenue or at the Manhattan Theater Club on 57th Street or whatever it is. But, of course, the first copy I sent was the New York Shakespeare Festival on Lafayette Street, which is about literally, I know that area real, real well. This is Joe Papp's old theater, of course. And it's about a 3-minute walk to the Green Street building where the Triangle Fire occurred. So I sent it off. I wrote to them. I said, are you interested in this play? And they wrote, I wrote hard copy on Friday. They'll only take hard copy. And by Monday afternoon, they were on the phone saying, send the play. So I sent the play, of course. That was obvious that they were very much interested in the theme. And I sent the play, and I called back a few weeks later. And they told me that the play was with their reader, who happens to be a senior at NYU.
You're kidding.
So that's what I mean when I say I have no punch left up there. They could at least farm it out to a graduate, right? So that's where you stand anymore, unless you have, these kids working at the Shakespeare Festival, all of 26, just got their degree from Yale. They don't know my name.
No.
You know, it would have all been different a long time ago. We'd have gone right to Pat. But that's part of the problem with living down here and trying to promote yourself. But I still keep at it. I'm a playwright. I'm an artist. I don't know. You know, I'm always had to go on a new play. Even some of these things that don't fly and don't work, I go back and I rework plays, and I work on new stuff. I don't seem to be fading. I think if I had been in New York all these years and maybe had a couple of successes, it might have been dangerous because, as you well know, the producer will say, give me the one you wrote the last time.
Yeah, right.
My dear old friend John Patrick Shanley hasn't really been heard from since Doubt. I mean, he's banging them out, and no doubt he'll come back because he's a wonderful writer. But I'm sure people are asking him for that.
Where's the next Doubt?
Yeah, well, they're asking him, you know, I'm sure they're asking him, it ends on a question mark. Will you answer the question?
Oh, the Doubt does,
yeah,
you mean?
Sure.
Yes, yes.
They're probably all looking for the sequel, and Brown probably doesn't have a sequel, isn't it?
There isn't an answer.
Right.
It is there. I mean,
there is no answer.
That's the point.
Right. But I'm sure that, you know, people are saying, give me another big Pulitzer Prize winning multi-million dollar motion picture, you
right.
know, and there are certain advantages, I suppose, to obscurity.
And so you just keep writing, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Are you working on something now?
Yeah, sure.
Can you tell?
Yeah, I had a play that was relatively successful in the 80s and into the early 90s. It played around the country and drew well and got some nice reviews. Wasn't done here, of course. I think we did a reading at Players years ago. It happens to be about an immigrant to the United States who left Ireland in 1968, shortly after the new troubles started to arise. And he left there in a hurry and came to the States and settled in and raised a family. And there's always been a question about his background and why he came to the States in such a hurry with no real roots here, while he was very much rooted in Northern Ireland, actually. And now I'm setting it in 2009. Where his son has just come back from Iraq, and he's been wounded by a bomb blast, a roadside bomb. And he's very much interested in finding out, and very much the family becomes very much aware of the fact that the father himself might have been a surreptitious bomber for the IRA against the North. And so that sets up an automatic conflict. And I know exactly how I'm going to do it, and it won't take long. The thing is that back in the 80s and 90s, when the play was out there, the offspring, the children, were still children.
Yes, right.
And now they're grown up and much more mature, and the son is very much more able to zero in on exactly what the father was doing. And it sets up a situation where they can very well become philosophical and political enemies. And I know exactly how to do it and where to go.
And is that the kind of thing that really turns you on, is that kind of conflict?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I don't write exactly Little Mary Sunshine. I've written a few some comedies, of course, but they're all dark comedies, a la Mamet. Some of you may have seen a play of mine called Shooters over at the Backlot, the late lamented Backlot a couple of years ago, which is a comedy about four assassins who turn on one another. The women turn against the men and chase down the men. And it's a very funny play, and it got some terrific reviews internationally. What do you say about a play about assassins? how funny can it be, right?
Yes. So it is, you've got kind of this dark vision, is that?
Yeah, I guess so.
Where do you think that comes from?
I don't know. Growing up in Manhattan, would that have to do with it?
Did you grow up in Manhattan?
I grew up until I was 11, and then my family moved to the main line of Philadelphia, which was a total, complete, exact reversal. But I remember and cherish those Manhattan years when I used to leave grammar school every day and get down and sneak into the polo grounds, and which was very routine. I thought kids all over the country did that, you know, and watched the Giants play and when they weren't very good. So it was a real interesting way to grow up.
Do you have siblings?
I had one brother.
Have you written about him or your family at all?
No. I haven't written about my family. But I think osmosis-wise, you write about your
family.
In
the sense that people are always writing about themselves, whether they mean to or not?
Yeah, yeah. Now, I grew up in a pretty conservative atmosphere.
But your plays are not?
I don't think so.
I'm sure they're not.
No. My family was pretty religious, and I'm not.
So you were kind of the rebel?
Yeah, I didn't set out to be, but my instincts just went in another direction. I used to be a voracious reader. I'm not so voracious anymore. Leading up to the playwriting, I was a voracious reader. I used to read three plays a day, but once you get involved yourself, you don't allow that much time for reading. But I am a voracious theater goer whenever I have the opportunity. It's usually more fun to witness these things than it is to read them.
But in plays are really written to be done, aren't they?
Oh, sure, yeah. I'm having a reading done of a play I'm very fond of. I'm having it done, and I'm doing it myself along with the actors, one of whom is Jamie Day, a wonderful actress, and the other who may be Mark Caragiulo, who's also a wonderful actor. But the play is about Jimmy Walker. It's a two-hander.
What do you mean a two-hander?
It's a two-character. Jimmy Walker was the rebel mayor of New York City in the 1920s. Mm-hmm. He was called Champagne Jimmy, and he was called the Midnight Mayor because he was always out late at night, and he was the perfect mayor for the Roaring Twenties. Now, Jimmy Walker was, as soon as the Roaring Twenties ended in 1929, Jimmy was one of the scapegoats. And he could no longer stay out until 4 o'clock in the morning partying with F. Scott Fitzgerald and friends. And so they started investigating Jimmy, and they found a little efficiency of $10,000, which today probably would earn him a slap on the wrist. But at the time, they were looking to get rid of Jimmy. His behavior was not exactly what his constituency smiled upon.
Yeah.
The fact that he had a mistress who was well-known, and the fact that he had a wife at home was well known. So Jimmy's time had passed, and he was asked to leave or He was run out of office. But Jimmy had been a songwriter.
Oh, wait a second. Run out of office by the party? By the party. Yeah. They said you're a liability.
Take a walk, Jimmy.
Take it, go.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, right.
And LaGuardia stepped in.
Mm.
I was much more a family man, and as this for a New York ticket, LaGuardia was half Italian and half Jewish. How can you lose?
No kidding.
How can you lose in New York? So Jimmy was a songwriter, had been a songwriter before he became mayor, and he knew all those guys. He knew Berlin, he knew the Gershwins, he was friends with them. He just wasn't very good. And he had one play on Broadway before, called The Dukes of Duluth. And they will never be heard from again. But Jimmy and his mistress, who was a showgirl and half his age, he was 46, she was 23, and she was an up-and-coming, rising showgirl. She was more than just a chorus girl. She was an up-and-coming ingenue. And they ran off to Europe, and Jimmy had the notion that he was going to write a musical over there for her. And it had to do with her 8 years in Europe trying to get this thing off the ground. And while it wasn't working, we see the deterioration of their marriage, but perhaps not the deterioration of their love.
Are we talking about the relationship between the mistress and Jimmy?
Yeah, right. They married ultimately.
Oh, they did marry.
Yeah. Jimmy got a divorce, which excluded him from the church, and he got a divorce and they married. But the marriage started to fall apart. And I think I've done enough homework to realize, not because of a lack of love, but because their careers weren't meshing. And she started to feel, I'm getting older now, people have forgotten me. People have forgotten I was an up-and-coming young showgirl and appearing in plays by Cole Porter and Irving Berlin and Jerome Kern on Broadway.
And it's costing me to be with you.
It's costing me. So they came back to New York. But I'm getting ahead of the game here. The important thing for Sarasota is the fact that Jimmy Walker was a good friend of John Ringling. And in this play, which is specifically written, I have a version specifically written for Sarasota. John Ringling calls Jimmy over in France. And John Ringling says, Jimmy, I have an eye on a theater in Oslo, Italy. Would you go over and take a look at it?
Is this true?
This is true.
Wow.
It's true that they were friends.
Yes. And it's true that he wanted the theater in Oslo.
Well, that remains to be seen. Let me finish the tale.
Oh, okay, sorry.
What I have in the play is the fact that John, who called Jimmy regularly, and they corresponded regularly, the main reason they corresponded regularly is because Jimmy wanted the art collection for the Met in New York. And John kept saying, no, I'm going to keep it down here in Oslo. And Jimmy kept saying, it'll all rot down there, termites, subtropics, et cetera. But of course, John took care of that, and he allowed for that, and he made provisions for the weather. But they became good friends anyway. I don't know if you're aware of the fact that John Ringling's boat caught fire and wound up in the bay at one point. Jimmy was on the boat at the time, as was Betty Compton, his mistress. They were on the boat, and they were playing cards. They were gambling. That's how close they were. And Jimmy even bought property down here, and I'm looking for the address. I think it might have been in Bee Ridge Road. Anyway, they were good friends. And as I have it, John makes a call to Jimmy when he's living on the Riviera, and says, go over and take a look at this theater in Italy, in Oslo, Italy. They're converting it to a movie theater, and I think that's a shame. I'm thinking of buying it, moving it over here. So Betty says, I'm not interested. If he moves it over there, he'll move it to Florida, and I don't want to go to Florida. I left Great Britain to come to New York, and now I can be a star. Florida's a step backwards. I lived in the Isle of Wight when I was a child. I don't want to live in another seacoast town. It's all fishing villages, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But they go over to, at the end of Act 1, they go over to Oslo, Italy, and that's where the scene takes place. They walk on stage, and Betty, there's only a ghost light on stage. The house is not lit. And Betty says, I don't even want to be here. Why are we here? And Jimmy calls off an Italian to the stage manager, or the house manager, and says, lights, please. And she says, where did you learn Italian? He says, Greenwich Village. And the lights come up, and Betty is absolutely flabbergasted.
Because it's an amazing theater.
And she's absolutely flabbergasted. And she said, oh, Jimmy, why didn't you tell me? I'd love to play this theater. Look at the Queen's box up there, and look at the murals, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And they go on, and they marvel at the theater. And she said, yes, let's see that it comes to Sarasota. And that's when Jimmy springs it on her. This is 1932. And he says, Betty, it won't happen. John is broke. All he has are his paintings, and he has no money left. The Depression has wiped him out. That is fact.
Wow.
That we know. We also know that the theater ultimately came here, of course, in the late 50s. And it wasn't Jim. It wasn't. It wasn't Ringling's doing, but it could have been.
Yeah.
And that's what theater's about.
Yeah, yeah.
So we are going to have. It's going to be done, not at the historic Oslo, where it should be done.
No kidding.
It's going to be done at Art Center Sarasota. It will be done as a reading with these two characters, and it will be a rather elaborate reading, and the public is invited, and contributions only. Although we hope to get some contributions in order to pay for the rental. And there will be wine served and conversation afterwards. And it's a specific push of trying to get somebody interested in doing it at the historic Oslo, where it should be done. I will elaborate upon the relationship between Ringling and Walker, which you can pick up any book on John Ringling, and you can pick up the couple of books on Jimmy Walker, and see that the relationship was solid.
Oh, it's a lovely idea.
Yeah.
It's lovely, and it's a little lighter, isn't it, than
the other things you've written? It's a really genuine love story. The irony of the whole situation is Betty preceded Jimmy. She died at the age of 40.
Wow.
Of cancer, of breast cancer in New York City. And so Jimmy, who was 63, he was heartbroken for the rest of his life. Even while she was married, she admitted that it was Jimmy she loved, and he was with her at the bedside when she died. It was a truly genuine love story, but damn theater got in the way. And I've seen it happen. You know, I've seen really true, nice relationships break up because of this theater obsession. Well, I have an obsession about writing plays. I don't have an obsession about living in the theater world, which I basically don't particularly like. Or else would I live down here? I didn't have a whole lot of friends in theater when I lived in New York. Because it's such a transient sort of world. You befriend people for 2 or 3 months, and then they're gone.
Yes.
To San Francisco. You may never see them again.
And also, it's so competitive.
Yeah, it's so competitive. I mean,
so few people actually get to do it, either writers or actors. And
yeah, it's very competitive.
So it's hard to be glad for your friend when they get the job you wanted, or they.
Yeah,
you know.
Playwrights don't. Well, I'm speaking for myself. Playwrights don't befriend playwrights a whole lot. I mean, I have friends who are playwrights, but not too many of them. And because there's simply a lot of jealousy and a lot of competition.
Yeah, right.
And
it's really a shame, because those are the people who would understand you the best, and
yeah.
They're the people who, for reasons you just said, are very difficult for you to be the closest to.
Yeah, yeah. So, but we'll see about this too, Andrew. I'm really fond of, and these are two terrific actors. So I'll say it'll be at Art Center Sarasota, which is a perfect space, by the way, for something like this. It wouldn't work for production, but it will work for reading. And we hope to have about 100 people, and it'd be a nice, genial situation.
Well, two things I always ask. Is there anything I didn't ask you that I should have asked you?
I don't suppose so. My wife and I are going to China in a week.
My God. Not
that's,
for theater.
That's interesting, isn't it? No, not. We're going to get away from theater. We're going to China. Somebody said to me, are you going over, taking your plays over?
You want to have them translated?
Right, right. Well, I imagine we're going to Hong Kong. I'll bet there are theaters over there. I should go look it up. I bet there are theaters that do plays in English. But the fact is, I said, no, it's a communist country, and they don't pay royalties. Then I said to myself, wait a minute. I'm not getting royalties anyway. What's the difference?
Right.
So that's what's question number two?
Well, and question number two is only when you think back on a life that has been spent really dedicated to this art, is there something to say about that, what it's like to have lived a...
Well, I just love to blue. I just love... I love writing plays. I think I'm very good at it. I've gotten a lot of awards. And it's just... I mean, it's more than a hobby with me. It's something I mean, I'm always looking for the next play, and I always come up with the next play. I don't get blocked for any great length of time. And if I don't know what I'd be doing with myself if I weren't writing plays. That's easy.
The writing?
Writing is easy. Now, I'm not going to say it's easy for everybody. It's certainly not easy for most people. But it's easy for me. Getting them on is a tough thing.
Yeah.
That's the rough thing. A lot of people are able to get them on who can't
write them that well, right? They're different skills. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. I mean, there are lots of ways to get your plays done, of course.
Right.
You can move to New York, and you can, let's face facts, you can pay to get your plays on.
Right.
You can make a significant donation to get your work done. And I think that almost every theater out there is willing to take it.
Especially now. Right, they need it so badly.
And I think we've all been to productions where we can walk away from it and say, somebody must have paid to get this play done. And I'm talking about locally as well. And, you know, there are various other ways. You can mount your own productions. But the tough thing is to get a play done on its merit.
Yeah.
Alone, nowadays.
Yeah.
And you can write a play with all women, which will get your foot in the door. And you can write a play with... all minority women, and that will further get you in the door. And the reason being, of course, not because these people have any great love for minority women, but because that's where the grants are.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And that's nice, that's good, and that's fine. The problem is, maybe the author doesn't know anything about minority women. And there aren't that many minority women out there writing plays. So there's a lot of politics involved. And right now, their grants have pretty much dried up. And the grants are out there for young, up-and-coming playwrights. The irony, of course, is that these young, up-and-coming playwrights will split from theater by the time they're 30, and they'll work their way into television. And if you think I'm kidding, you go back and look at plays that were done in off Broadway, New York City, 3 and 4 years ago, that are very well received. And then you go look at the credits on some of these television shows, and you'll see, Neil LaBute, and the Teresa Rebeck, and who was that woman who wrote Kiss, Diana Son, and these others, and they're all doing TV work. And that's okay.
Yeah.
That's fine.
But it's not...
But to nurture theater writers and have them go into TV is a little sort of kissing that grant goodbye.
Yeah.
Because they're doing a lot better in TV than they would be doing...
Well, it's not. It's not supporting the theater.
Right. I don't blame them.
Well, of course not. That's where the money is, but
I don't blame them. I don't blame them, and I probably, in this day and age, would do the same thing. But I was offered, when I was a young playwright, I was with William Morris, and I was offered film opportunities that I turned down, fatefully, fate, F-A-T-E, in retrospect, I should have taken. But the first one I was offered was... a chance, but I was getting nice reviews in the New York Times, and I've been reviewed 5 times in the New York Times, mostly positive. And after about 2 nice reviews in the New York Times, William Morris Agency, my agent came to me, and she also handled Edward Albee and Ethel Fugard. She was not a stiff, and I was not a stiff. And she came to me, she said, I have a movie for you, $50,000, easy bucks. We're going back 30 some years ago, $50,000, big money today. I said, what do I have to do? She said, well, it's an action adventure. I said, well, what do I have to do? She said, well, do you know wrestling? I said, no. I said, Esther, I don't sit home at night and watch wrestling. I'm usually at the theater. She said, well, they want an action adventure about two young up-and-coming wrestling stars. I said, keep talking. She said, do you know Hulk Hogan? I said, no. She said, do you know Andre the Giant? I said, I said, isn't he the great big guy, 7 foot something? She said, yes. Well, they want a movie about starring those two guys. I said, I'll pass.
Yeah.
I think the movie was ultimately made, and I think the audience passed. I don't know. Maybe it was, I don't know. But that was a bad move on my part.
Yeah. You were idealistic.
Yeah, but the Mars Agency wasn't, of course. They tell you they are.
Right.
They tell you they are, but they got very cool to me after that.
Yeah.
And I wrote one TV pilot. I wrote two TV pilots, actually. Neither one of them were done. But that's not rare. That's the rule.
That's the rule, right.
I mean, you know, 4 out of 5 TV pilots never see the light of day. I made nice money, of course, but fortunately I invested it. Because I was teaching at the time, I had a nice college assistant professorship, so I invested the money in pretty wisely. So I passed on the opportunity. I mean, I would love to have written a screenplay if it had been, you know, quality, if it had been significant, but that never came along. So I have ideas now, but they're not chasing after me.
But you never know.
I mean, I just accepted my award over at Longboat Key last week. I'm embarrassed to say, I forget the title, Continuing Creativity Award that they give to geezers. Here's your last award before the end. Keep working. That was nice, but they're not looking for screenwriters down here. Older screenwriters.
Well, I don't know. The population has aged so that the people with the money and the people who read and the people who go to the theater are all older.
Well, here's an interesting question for you. How come nobody went to the Neil Simon play last week?
What Neil Simon
play? You know that.
No, I don't.
Brighton Beach Memories and Lost in Yonkers both opened
in New York?
In New York, Broadway revivals to strong reviews and died the death immediately. They opened on Tuesday and Wednesday and came down on Saturday.
Oh, my God. I had no idea.
It was like an 18% advance.
Wow. Well, maybe you... How many times can you do Brighton Beach?
Yeah,
I mean, who's around who hasn't seen it yet? You know, I mean, my God.
I think you're right.
You know, the movie, the play, it's played everywhere.
I think the young audience probably feels, well... Neil Simon, he's that old guy.
Old guy, right.
And they probably wouldn't be interested in Simon because he's a cliche. But he's a cliche because everything he wrote
has
been incorporated and utilized and done by lesser writers.
Yes.
Who they see on TV.
That's right.
So I think Simon was interviewed. He's 82 now and he's pretty hard hit by it. I'm not going to shed any tears for Neil.
Oh, please!
He's not going to be in the—he's not going to be on the soup line next week. But I think it's kind of interesting, and it's big buzz in New York. You got to Google it up.
Yeah, well, I'm sure that's
right.
Everybody
has an opinion.
I'm sure that's right, and it is a little shocking, but still, I mean, if they were going to revive anything, it seems to me. I mean, that's played everywhere.
Yeah, well, that's your—you put the finger on it, I think.
You know, I mean, my God.
Yeah. But yeah, maybe you're right. I'm not sure that applies to theater.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I brought it up because in a way, it seems to me that the same people who read are the same people who go to the theater. You know,
yeah,
what I mean?
There's a little bit different situation here insofar as theater is so much into grants.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah.
You mean in order to get anything on, you need to get a grant?
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, all these, the theaters that we see, Oslo and FST and...
That's how they're being supported, is by the grant?
Yeah, a good portion of What yeah. they do is it comes through grants, and I think grants people are interested in the new, and
you know, I'm sorry, I'm lost on this idea, but you know, Menopause the musical, it's a hit everywhere.
Oh yeah,
it's. I mean,
they're reviving it
at the Oslo. They've done it. How many times they've done it? And I have friends who've seen it more than once, and that's that audience.
But do your friends? Do they? Let me ask you something.
Yeah.
And I may be wrong here, but do those same people go out and see, let's say, Miss Julie at the conservatory last year?
Maybe not, but wait a second, wait. I mean, there's a big difference between Miss Julie and Menopause the Musical, and not just because Menopause the Musical is silly,
yeah,
and Miss Julie is not,
right.
But because Miss Julie is about a very specific kind of person that most of these people are not.
Right.
And also, when was Miss Julie written? I mean, it's, what, 100 years ago?
Yeah.
Right. So, so what I'm saying is that audience might be willing to see a musical about a modern-day woman struggling with not being understood. Do you know, what?
That's interesting because Patrick Marber just wrote an update of Miss Julie. That was a big hit in London and just opened in New York.
I saw that.
Right.
It's Miss Julie Revisited or something, right? Or after
like
Miss Julie.
After Miss Julie.
I saw
right.
that, and I'm interested.
Yes. Yeah, so
see,
right.
But that's the point.
Yeah.
That's the point.
All
that
right.
you write to the audience.
Yeah, well, I perfectly understand that, and I can see why Oslo would revive it. It's money in the bank.
What just occurred to me is that everything that you've talked about that you have written, most of what you've talked about, not everything, but is pretty historical. I mean, it's like you like to draw on the history. Am I wrong about that?
I made my way. I made my way back to the University of Pennsylvania to do graduate work in American Civ.
Uh-huh.
And that segues into a lot of what I do. Yeah, I got even with them for kicking me out. I can get an MA in American Civ, and that's a big influence.
Clearly, the triangle thing, Jimmy Walker.
Right. That's another factor. I don't write specifically about history, but I found that a lot of theaters aren't interested in history.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure why. I think it must be the whim of the artistic director.
Mm-hmm.
And I've already made my point that I think they're all behind the times anyway. But I don't know why they wouldn't be interested in history, but you know, I can point you to some of the, you know, we all have trade publications and all, and I can point you to certain theaters who specify no history plays, please.
Really?
I think that, I mean, Hamlet's a history play, Shakespeare wrote history plays, and I don't know why that is.
I don't either.
I mean, just because a history play doesn't mean it can't be contemporary.
No, I think, for example, you know, when you talk about Jimmy Walker,
sure.
You know, I mean, that's a contemporary story. Just because it happened 100 years ago, it doesn't mean
we're talking about political corruption.
Well, and at the Triangle Fire, what is that? I mean,
right.
that was all political corruption, wasn't it?
Pardon? That was all corruption. Yeah,
yeah
that was
right.
all, you know, what I write about in the Triangle Fire play is not so much about the fire.
No, it's about what led to it.
The people on the take.
Yeah, right.
And I mean, how that affected them.
How what could be more contemporary?
Right.
Did you just, you know, if you look at the, you know, all those, I mean, the Madoffs and the Nadels
sure.
and all that, it's all the same thing, right? I mean, it's,
right.
you know, people looking out for their own at the expense of others and not caring.
Right. Well, that fire down in South Carolina a few years ago all the workers died because the doors were locked.
Right.
It's the exact same thing.
Right, it's repeat.
And of course the doors were locked because it would cut into their profit motive if
somebody went to the bathroom
or took a smoke.
Right.
And it's the same thing.
That's That's right. It's the same. Well, this has been really interesting for me. And I appreciate you taking all the time.
Oh, my pleasure, Lynn.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The Spanish philosopher George Santayana told us that those of us who forget the past are doomed to repeat it. And so we count on people like Jack Gilhooly, who study history and then turn it into art so that we can see it, so that perhaps we will remember, and perhaps some of us will avoid the doom of repeating the mistakes of the past. Well, we're running out of time for this show, so I need to thank, as I always do, Josh Hackney, who not only comes here and fixes the show to the extent that it can be fixed, given my technological inadequacy, but is helping me in every possible way that has anything to do with computers. I got a little computer, you know, a mini. Well, I mean, I need everything put in it. I need to know how to work it. You know, it's very nice. I can buy the equipment, but then I don't know what to do with it. So then there's Josh to the rescue. So if you have any issues that are related to computers, to IT, to the internet, to recording, to electronics, you just need somebody nice to talk to, you want to talk to Josh. And so you can get him by going up on my website, thelynnshow.com, thelynnshow. Don't leave the E out of the Lynn. You get a different Lynn. So as always, I hope that you heard something that you can use in today's show, something that will help you to avoid the doom of repeating the mistakes of the past, something that amused you, or something you knew but had forgotten, something you didn't know and are glad to now know. Anyway, something that will bring you back, because I will be here next week, same time, same station. And I sure hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you see my face and figure. I've both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't out of sight, no, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly, well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes, every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flame. gentle.